Welcome to Season 16 of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I share stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go! Welcome back. I'm excited you're here. If you're brand new, welcome. If you come back every single week, thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'm super excited for you to hear this week's featured conversation with my friend Tim Hiller. But before we get there, I just want to thank all of you who have signed up or if you've expressed interest in our brand new Ultimate Leadership Academy. If you're unfamiliar, it's a one-of-a-kind opportunity that we're only running twice a year. That includes a one-on-one coaching call with me, our Welder Leader 360 assessment and report, plus monthly training sessions led by me and our other coaches to help you become the very best leader you can be and help you apply the lessons to help you get better performance from yourself and your team from a leadership perspective. Go to learnloft.com/Ultimate Leadership Academy. That's learnloft.com/Ultimate Leadership Academy to learn more and sign up. There is limited space available, so do not miss your chance. Now, this week's feature conversation is with my friend Tim Hiller. He is a former NFL and Division I college quarterback. Today, he leads a talent management function inside of Stryker, a Fortune 500 company based out of Michigan. So he has this unique perspective of leadership from an athletic perspective, from leading on the front lines at a Fortune 500 company, and he's an in-demand speaker and co-founder of his own training and character-building company that helped with athletes in high school. This guy is an absolute beast. I loved every minute of it. I know you will as well. So without further ado, here's my interesting conversation with my friend, Tim Hiller.
Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
I want you to take me back to your football days. You played, you were a star in high school. You went on to excel at Western Michigan University as quarterback. You played in the NFL for a little bit. Take me back to being a leader, walking into a huddle.
You know, it's interesting. I'll tell a very short story. When I was a sophomore in high school, I had a pretty transformative moment that, you know, I carry with me even to this day. I was, you know, this runny nose sophomore trying to figure out how to lead a team and was really more concerned about playing time than anything else. And long story short, had a game where I threw 5 interceptions, and I remember handling it, you know, in not a good fashion and, you know, tossing my helmet and doing some things I'm not proud of at that, you know, age of 15 or 16. And I remember my coach grabbing me and kind of walking me away from the team and saying, "Hey, Tim, listen, we will go as you go. We will go as you go." And I think it set a tone for me for a long time that leadership by your example, by how you carry yourself, by your posture, by your body language, by all these things is really important, especially in a huddle. And so for me, as I got older, that came down to things like practicing saying the play, especially long, complex ones, over and over again, so that when I stepped in there, there was a level of credibility even in that 5 to 10 seconds of eye contact or how you speak. That how you carry yourself, how you go is how the team goes. And so I think that that's really powerful because you only have a moment to influence. And I think that applies in all areas of life and business.
I very much believe teams will only go as far as their leader will take them, much like you're suggesting there. But I think what's so unique about a football huddle is you are 30 seconds away from pure execution. Yeah. I mean, the ball is hiked. And the play is off. I mean, it is just action-oriented stuff. And it works sometimes. It's not quite like that, is it? What lessons have you learned from that football huddle or all the things that go into leading as the most important position on a football team to now your professional journey or leading a team at work?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that you touched on is really comes down to preparation. So when you think about the average play in a game of football is about 5 seconds, give or take, you know, from whistle to whistle, and that's it. And you think about all the time in the film room, all the time on the practice field, all the time to get ready for that 5 seconds. It's a level of lots of preparation and then intense execution, as you said. And so I think when you think about an R&D project, right? I mean, just years of effort to launch a product. If you think about, you know, my world today, delivering training or, you know, talent development, lots and lots of preparation for a moment in front of the right group or a moment coaching a leader. You spend so much effort getting ready. You know, I jokingly liken it sometimes to, you know, you own a boat, right? I mean, every hour on the water, there's 3 hours taking care of the boat. And I think that's really one of the things I carry with me to this day from the football world is so much preparation for a moment that you have to seize because you may not get another shot.
You also studied under one of the most famous quarterbacks of all time, Peyton Manning. In your short time working with Peyton, what's a lesson you learned from him?
Yeah, there are so many. The one that is top of mind is the approach of coming in every day like a rookie. And when I say that, you know, I came in 2010. It was Peyton's last year in Indianapolis before they released him and he had his second neck surgery. And then he, you know, went on for a few more years in Denver, but he was late in his career at that point. And here I was, an undrafted free agent that you know, got almost a year in Indianapolis. And when I look back on that experience, he approached every day with kind of that beginner's mind. I mean, he really came in. I mean, he had been through the installation of the offense however many times. I mean, just 50 plus times, you know, because you do it twice a year. And he would ask questions that were like rookie questions. He would make sure that he understood the coach's intent. He would, you know, show up for OTAs. A lot of veterans, you know, will do things with their own trainer and not come until training camp or right before training camp. And Peyton was at everything all off season. And so I think watching a veteran of his caliber approach every day like a rookie was very, you know, challenging, inspiring. And I'd like to think that it stuck with me in terms of how curious I am, how I ask questions when I'm leading a team, how I'm trying to attack whatever I'm learning or approaching each day.
Now, you got to be honest with me. When he walked in the room for the first time, you had to be like, oh, there's Peyton. I mean, was there any of that? Like, you're in the same room as that guy?
I did have one of those moments, right? Where, I mean, you walk around that locker room. I was very lucky to be there during a year where a lot of the guys that built that franchise into what it was for a number of years were there. So, I mean, I remember walking around the locker room and I had that kind of 5-minute moment of like, whoa, like Dallas Clark and Reggie Wayne and Jeff Saturday and Peyton Manning. You see the names, right? And then you kind of got to snap out of it and say, all right, it's time to work. But yeah, definitely had a couple of those moments along the way.
I think one of the things that's really interesting about your journey, and so many people they can't relate to being in an NFL locker room, but they can all relate to failing at something. When you decided it was that you weren't going to make it in the NFL, whether that be by choice or by a team cutting you for the fourth time, what were those emotions like? What was going through your head in that moment when you made that decision? For yourself or made by somebody else?
Yeah, this is a great question. And it's fresh in my mind. I had the opportunity to do a Q&A and share some of this story with a high potential leadership academy at Stryker not that long ago where I work today. And, you know, if you've ever seen the movie Moneyball, my personal experience of the very first time I got cut, which you mentioned it did happen four times, was with the Indianapolis Colts. And it was kind of like that scene in Moneyball. You know, where Brad Pitt sends his buddy there to make a cut. I mean, I literally was, we were getting ready to play the Green Bay Packers at the end of the preseason. I was going to be playing a lot. I was going to get a lot of reps that particular game for the second week in a row. It, you know, looked really promising for me, but we had had some defensive backs go down the week before and we just needed some help in the secondary. And so it kind of became a numbers game. And unfortunately I fell victim to that. And so we had a double that day. We had two a days. I walked down the hallway, between practices, grab some lunch. I'm going to watch film. And one of the scouts grabbed me. And usually there was a player personnel guy that did a lot of the releasing of players. And sometimes scouts would grab us and get their, you know, ask for us for their opinions on, or our opinions on players we competed against in college and different things. And so I go to this guy's office to sit down. I'm expecting him to, you know, kind of ask me some questions about somebody in the MAC that I competed against or whatever. And he slides me some termination paperwork and says, hey, we got to let you go. Coach Caldwell's waiting in the office. You know, and so it was this kind of moment of total being blindsided, because when you're at that level, you have to have a level of focus and determination. I mean, I had no plan B. You know, I had put everything on hold and said, I'm going after this. I'm going to do this for, you know, 3 to 5 years. This is going to be my occupation. And all of a sudden, in a drop of a hat, in a moment, it's done. And, you know, you find yourself turning in your playbook, you find yourself in the locker room. I mean, I remember they gave me like a big, you know, however many gallon black, like yard, you know, yard waste trash bag, and just putting all my stuff in a trash bag. And like by that night, I was back in like West Michigan sleeping at my in-laws' house. You know, it was so swift. And, you know, I can now speak about it with little emotion because I've had the time to process, but it was very, you know, you felt embarrassed. You felt like a failure. You felt like you let people down. It was a hard time.
What did it teach you though? I mean, what do you still carry today? I mean, obviously you carry that disappointment of not playing in an NFL game or not being a starting quarterback in the NFL. That was probably your dream for so long. Mm-hmm. But what from that moment do you still carry today in your professional life?
Yeah. You know, I think it frames the way I look at risk. Because if I look back on that, you know, yeah, it was hard and it happened more times after that. You know, you come to learn it's a part of the business of the NFL or any professional sport. And that's the way it goes for everybody at some point, unless you choose to retire, which very few get the opportunity to do that. And I look back on that and I think it really has poised me to ask lots of questions about making sure I don't regret things. You know, I think about a lot of times I have people come to my office today and say things like, you know, should I apply for the job? Should I interview for this? Should I move? Should I try these things? And the question I often bring back to them, rather than giving them an answer, is ask them a question and say, if you saw someone else in that position, would you be bummed out? Would you regret that? If you saw someone else doing what you're considering doing, would you say, man, I wish that was me? And if so, then you got to go for it. And I look back on that experience and it was hard. It's disappointing. I often did feel like I failed. But when I look back on it now, I'm so glad for it. I have no regrets. I did the best I could, and I really do have that peace of mind. And I think if you have a risk in front of you, you gotta go for it if you think you'll have any kind of regret.
Well, let's transition then to the professional world, because you work for an incredible company that's it's kind of become a little bit of the staple when it comes to talent management. That is Stryker. You decide football is no longer a viable path for you. You're going to move on, go in a different direction. And now you're in a talent management role with a team. And so the two areas I really want to cover here is you lead a team on the front lines of a large organization. And so often the people we have on the show, they're CEOs or they're somewhere where a lot of our audience can't exactly relate. Mm-hmm. But I think you specifically in your role now, a lot of people can relate to leading a team at a big organization or being inside an organization with a lot of hierarchy or even a lot of politics. Talk to me about what is the same of being a leader on the football field to now leading a team inside of a larger organization.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, I mean, at Stryker, we're about $12.5 billion in sales globally. We have over 30,000 employees. We call ourselves a small but mighty team. I'm in our instruments division, which is over $2.5 billion of that $12.5 billion. So it's a pretty sizable division. And our team supports over 2,000 employees globally with their personal, professional, and leadership development, as well as their sales training. So we have a lot on our plate. And I guess I go back and I think it's really about rallying around a common goal. You know, John, we use a tool in my team. I've had the honor and privilege of working for some great leaders at Stryker in my 5 years there, who are veterans or who are West Point graduates. And there's a tool that, you know, got some publicity through Harvard Business Review a few years ago called Commander's Intent. And we have a Commander's Intent for our team, and it is to partner with our employees to help grow their personal, professional, and leadership development. And so that's what we lead with. That's our elevator pitch. That's what we tell people what we do. And I think that's very similar to a football locker room, because we just had clarity that every week the goal was to defeat the opponent. I mean, we had different things we wanted to attain, but at the end of the day, the goal was the same. And so I think for us, leading with why and having a very, very clear purpose that guides our decision making, if it doesn't do those three things, growing people's personal, professional, and leadership development, we don't do it. It gives us focus. It gives us a clear mission, and everybody on the team is crystal clear on it. And so that's something that we lead with.
Do you think more frontline managers should have that commander's intent?
I think so. You know, at the end of the day, everything should connect back to the business's strategy. And we know that as well. And so what we try to do is everything we take on, we can connect our personal mission as a team back to the strategy of our division. We're doing a lot of work this year, as an example, with R&D. And one of our divisional president's goals is to use his words, supercharge the innovation engine. So he wants to invest in R&D. He wants to put profit back in developing new products. And so we've been doing a lot of performance team coaching and team building with these different R&D project teams that bring people from different functions together to produce a product. And we're linking our purpose to the divisional strategy. And so I think those things are really powerful. They give us focus. A lot of times you can just be busy, especially in a company as big as ours. You're doing stuff, but what are you really achieving? And so for us, having that clear purpose gives us clarity to say yes and no to things and to set expectations.
Well, in my first role leading a team, I tell the story often that I ended, it ended poorly for me and my team. I had a team member look me right in the eyes when I was letting her, after I let her go. And she said, "John, I didn't know what we were doing. I didn't know where we were going. And I certainly didn't know how I was helping us get there." And I'll never forget having my head in my hands in tears after she left my office, knowing that I had failed her from a leadership perspective. If you had a moment in this 5 years leading a team and being a, you know, air quotes, leader in the workplace where you thought, man, this is a lot harder than I thought it was, from a human being perspective?
Yeah. I've had a lot of those moments, John. And I think probably the first one I had was that I had a team member who actually no longer works at the organization. We still maintain, you know, a friendship. I get the occasional Facebook message, and I'm happy. I only share that to say that the relationship survived, right? Mm-hmm. Survived the workplace consequence, because I believe leadership is a relationship. And I remember sitting down and we had this individual and another coworker and the same team, and one got a promotion and one didn't. And at the time, I remember this performance evaluation going really well. And then some time had passed, and then there was another, you know, one-on-one meeting, and then the performance evaluation came back out in light of the other team member, getting the promotion. And then there was emotion involved in that. And it was a very, you know, challenging conversation. But what it taught me was the value of expectations, because we hire really talented people, as do organizations everywhere. And if you don't set clear expectations, frustration happens, because either there's no expectations, so people make up their own, and then there's a mismatch, or if your expectations are not clear, then again, there's that, you know, kind of ships passing in the night. You're not on the same page. And so what I found is that, man, if I can work with people to set and get them involved in the process of setting really clear objectives and expectations up front, we avoid a whole lot of headache later, because we're both clear and they feel like they have had a say in what they're working on for the year that meets that commander's intent purpose. And so I've had some tough moments, but for me, leadership is truly two things. I think relationship and stewardship. You know, stewardship is taking care of something. And so I just view the people that are part of our team as people I need to take care of for this season. And I try to do the best I can with that.
I love the word stewardship. I want to go back though to this. I think a lot of people would be like, yeah, I mean, we all have had those moments or expectations. I didn't set clear expectations. Are you setting clear expectations for the results that you're after, or something different?
Yeah, no, I think it needs to be results based, because here's the thing. I don't have time to micromanage people. I just don't. I mean, at Stryker, it's pretty clear the expectation is, as a manager, you're a player coach. You still have your own objectives and things you need to, you know, focus on. We're not just going to be able to manage people. And so for me, usually the objective setting process looks something like, hey, we're going to write our objectives, but you're going to take the first draft. And here's some ideas I have, but take it and run with it. And then it's kind of this iterative back and forth process where the first draft of those goals is actually written by the employee, not by me. And I'm just kind of the editor, advisor, coach. And then we lock it in on what that looks like. And we try to put as many measures as we can. In my world, in the HR and talent development, it's a little hard to measure that sometimes, but we try to set some metrics that we agree upon. And then we check in often. You know, I've had objectives, gosh, I think every year I've been in this role, where we've edited them or deleted one or added a new one because the business changes and we need to support the strategy. And I think you have to be flexible enough to do that if what you set as a goal is no longer relevant. And so for me, it's set clear expectations, touch base a lot. You know, I mean, I usually do a one-on-one weekly if I can with everybody on the team, even for 30 minutes, just to check in. And then it's just no secret. I mean, when we get to performance reviews, it's like we already know what's going to happen. And it's just, summing up what we've already been talking about every week all year.
This is interesting because I think that is extremely important. Not having one performance review where everybody's getting surprised. But as a former athlete, as someone that's, you know, been successful in sports, I've really wrestled with this idea of the clear expectations being about results-oriented things versus process-oriented things. And I want to give you an example, meaning if we know the outcome that we're all after is, you know, X number of workshops completed or X number of people impacted. Well, and I'm trying to talk training and development, but let's use something more specifically like sales. You know, we know the end goal is we want to hit, you know, $1 million in quota attainment for the year.
Yep.
I found it much more powerful to look for different things other than the results as a frontline manager, meaning, you know, I'm going to measure your effort every single day. I'm going to measure your coachability every single day. I'm going to measure your, you know, your willingness to try new things every, whatever those process oriented things are, the things that are going to impact the behaviors that will ultimately impact the results. How have you thought about splitting those two things up, or are they all in the same expectations?
That's great. That's a brilliant question. And I feel very fortunate, to work for an organization that believes the same thing you're saying, John. And so one of the things that we have at Stryker, it's fairly new. We're in the, you know, the about 3-year journey here. And it's still catching on, but I'm a deep believer in it, is we have this concept called leadership expectations. And so we have 5 things at Stryker that we say, these are what the things that we expect from leaders. They're things like developing talent, building organizational capability, delivering results, setting direction, inspiring others. Those are our 5 kind of pillars. And there's behavioral statements under them. So, you know, so there are times, admittedly, where they feel a little bit rigid, but what they do is they give you clarity for the how. We're very good at, like, our why, right? Our why as an organization is to, together with the customers, we're driven to make healthcare better. And then as a team, we have our mission of the personal, professional, and leadership development. So that's our why. The objectives are your what, but a lot of times, I agree with what you're saying, the how is missing. We're very lucky. We have that leadership expectations piece, and there's literally a segment in some of the forms that we use that encourages us as managers to pick something, say setting direction, and provide some examples of how we hope to have that individual set direction. And that is reviewed with the what. So we don't only talk about what did you accomplish, but how did you get there? And to mention sales, this is something that's very relevant in our sales force, because if you have a $3 million quota in your territory, but you just trampled people to get there and you didn't take care of your customer and you were a bad teammate in your region, but you hit your quota, like I think we're sending the message, it's not good enough just to hit the number. How you hit the number matters. And so that's how we do it, John. Is it perfect? No. Do I find it to work? Yeah. And I think I interject some of my own flair and style into that. But I think defining the how is very important for organizations.
Well, it's also your specific team is interesting too, or your organization, because you're hiring a lot of former athletes, a lot of driven people that get out of bed at 5 a.m. ready to go, man.
Sure. And, oh, yeah.
And I think there's something to that talent piece, obviously being a really core component. I was spending some time when I had the chance to interview Jay Wright, and I'll never forget, he said, you know, we obviously look for talent. And once you get to a certain level of talent, you know, I'm looking for character and I'm looking for competitiveness. And there's something about people at Stryker that kind of wake up competitive or driven or, you know, looking to be successful. And once you kind of check that box as a core attribute for someone on your team, maybe some of the process oriented things like coming in with a positive attitude or, you know, coming in with strong work ethic, some of those are checked off naturally. And I think in some other leaders that might run other teams, you might not have that DNA, which makes leading a team harder. And you feel like you're kind of running up against a wall all the time when someone might not be that driven. And you might not be faced with that at Stryker.
Yeah, no, you're right. And we do, you know, Gallup is a very important partner of ours. They have been for years. And, you know, we do some interviewing and use some tools that help us measure fit. With our culture and with some of our values, and to your point, some of that natural hardwiring to be a self-starter. But there are different things needed in different parts of the organization, right? The skill set we need from a very important software engineer is very different than what we need from a very important salesperson. And so, you know, we really do believe in talent. And if I were to define talent in my own words, John, I would say, you know, talent is the unique way that you think, that you feel, and that you act, you know, and I'll throw examples out there. You know, if I put a budget in front of you, some people would be super excited to build that budget and some people would rather do something else. That's the unique way you think or the unique way you feel, you know. I mean, you and I are talking early in the morning when the sunrise comes up, you and I are might not even notice it. We might get to work. Some other people might pause and see that. It's a unique way you feel. And so these are things that you can't train. They're innate to people, right? They're just, they're part of their DNA. They're, as you said, they're hardwired this way. And so when you hire talented people, I think the important thing to remember is sometimes it is more challenging because you have these folks that want to just get off and running and you don't need to micromanage them. But sometimes if you use the example of, say, like a thoroughbred horse, right? Every now and then a thoroughbred horse will kick you or bite you. And you have to remember that with talented people, it's about setting good direction and then staying out of the way and saying, how can I support you? How can I serve you? How can I assist you? And I think talent wins. I mean, it's, you know, in the football world, we used to say it's not about the X's and the O's. It's about the Jimmies and the Joes. And it's really about the people that you put in position on the field to make plays. And I see that play out every day at work.
I have this, I very much believe in something we call a maximizing mantra. And all a maximizing mantra is a catchphrase or something that we use and that hopefully will impact the behaviors of the team. And so in order to, you know, live out that catchphrase, the behaviors will have to be a certain way. And one of my favorite catchphrase, maximizing mantras right now is make a play. And I feel like if anyone on our team can, you know, in order to be able to say I made a play today, their behaviors have to be slightly different. And you just were talking about football with that saying, and I don't know, there's something about the power of words, isn't there, in leadership that can help dictate and determine the behaviors of your team.
Your words are so important. We just were, you know, had a leadership academy again at Stryker, as I mentioned, and we were interviewing a leader. We try to bring in some different senior people to talk to groups and just do Q&A and be casual and, you know, authentic. And one of them talked about the difference between telling and asking. And I thought it was really interesting that he said, you know, I would tell people to do things or I would kind of give a directive and I wasn't maybe clear. And because I was in the position of authority and leadership, people just started running. They started doing things. And I'd be like, whoa, what? Slow down. Why are you doing that? And I'd be like, well, you said so. And you kind of step back and say, wow, like I did. I set that expectation. Like my words really matter. And I think that's so true. You know, and I think for us, or I guess me at a personal level, I really try to build into our team an orientation of service. And, you know, I mean, I just share this. My email signature is three words. Maybe it is my mantra, you know, John, in the spirit of what you said there. My email signature says here to serve. And I really do believe that. I think that's a mantra I try to live. I'm sure I fail every day, but being in a posture of service to others. And I want my team to have that mindset because we are a bit of a shared service in the business. We need to support the strategy of the business. And so we need to take on that posture of service to say, you know, I'm here to support you. And so it may not be the normal maximizing mantra, but I think that's really what we try to instill in our team.
A lot of people would be like, that's awesome, Tim. I mean, honestly, you're really living out what leadership is all about, serving and empowering other people. It's great that it's your mantra. How do you get your people to serve? Is that something that comes innate in them or is that something you can build in them?
Yeah, you know, so here's how I would answer that. I'm trained a bit from the job I had prior at Stryker, which was in the customer care, customer service organization. So specifically, we have a call center group that's, you know, 75 plus employees. And I spent a couple years in that environment. I knew nothing about that world at the time. But you have to come into every interaction. Every time somebody calls that group, it's because something is wrong or they don't have something they need. So think about that, right? Every single time the phone rings, something's off. And it's an opportunity to protect the business and build loyalty to make things right again. And so I think that really was shaping for me in how I view things. And, you know, to your point, I think it is a bit innate in my team. I really do. It's something I look for when I hire. It's something that we talk about in the interview process. Because if you can't be flexible enough to say, okay, I'm in a posture of service to you, and even if you pivot and it's a little bit frustrating that you've changed direction, you're my customer, right? We view our people that we serve internally as customers. You are my customer. Are you the you know, doctor at the hospital? No, but you're my customer. You're who we serve. And so we need to listen to them. We need to be attentive to their needs, and we need to, you know, pivot and shift with them. And it's something we talk about. We talk about the customer experience that we've given in a training program or in a coaching session or whatever it is. And I think that's really important.
I think this is a good time to make a point, which is a lot of people will say in an interview process, yeah, I serve other people, or, you know, I do XYZ for other people. And it's easy to take their word for it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's another thing to ask for a specific example where they served. So if you're out there leading a team and you're interviewing people for your team, don't stop at just taking someone's word that they have a servant heart. Ask specifically. Tell me a time when. Tell me a time when you did XYZ. Tell me a time when you served someone outside of work. So, and then if they're able to play that back to you, you know they have that in their heart. They might have volunteered mm-hmm. at their church. They might have gone on a mission trip. They might have, you know, whatever those examples of service are. Because when push comes to shove and that person then has to serve at work and it's not in their heart, it will be very difficult for them. They'll default to thinking about themselves, which many times in the workplace, you know, if you think of it from a management perspective, Tim, the people want to – they protect their turf, if you will, in a large environment. Yeah. It's hard to think of, you know – developing someone beyond yourself because you want to protect or keep safety to the job that you have. And it's natural in a professional environment, but in reality, what we want is developing people beyond where we are, and it ultimately will make you look better as well. But I think there's something to looking for people that have a servant heart, and I think it will help you as a frontline manager.
So true. And you can feel it. You really can feel it. It's hard to put your finger exactly on it, but you know it when you see it. You know it when you're around somebody who believes it. And you took the words out of my mouth. I mean, one of my favorite, you know, interview, it's not even a question, really. It's a kind of a finish this statement is, you know, tell me about a time when, and you, whatever it is, fill in that statement. Tell me about a time when you designed a training program. Tell me about a time when you worked with somebody to solve a problem. One of the things to even take that a step further, John, is, you know, I love to take a panel approach anytime I interview people, and we always do a presentation, and the presentation is always situational. So I've seen a lot of people do, you know, tell us about yourself in 15 minutes. I think that's great. And I like to incorporate some of that too, but I always try to give them a scenario of a real problem my team is working on. And, you know, at a simple level, tell me how you'd attack it and present it to us. And it helps me see thought process. It helps me see that servant heart. You know, are they doing a little bit of like needs assessment, voice of customer? Are they listening? Because a posture of service is a posture of listening and learning and humility. And if we don't model that, or that person's not willing to do that, they're jumping right into their ideas. It's a bit of a red flag, right? You have to pause. And so I think you're so wise in saying that. Give me an example. Show me.
I love that. I mean, you know, and so often one of the things I've learned as I've really developed as a leader is, I feel like I was always trying to hire or find someone on the team that was a master in the need that we had as a team. Mm. Meaning, like, if we had a gap in, you know, writing or editing, you know, I wanted to get someone that was a master in that skill. But what I found now later is that if I'm hiring someone that's really, really, really good in that skill, it's hard to keep them really interested in the role for very long.
Yeah.
How have you thought about filling out your team as a frontline manager? Are you hiring masters of the skill needed, or are you looking for some kind of somebody that's really looking to learn or grow and develop new skills? And then obviously that presents unique challenges because they're not a master in the skill that you need right now. But I'm curious right. how you think about filling out a team now, and how a frontline manager at an organization should think about filling out a team.
Yeah, that's great. So when when it comes to interviewing, we'll just kind of get into that part of it. I always take a panel approach, which means I'm going to bring, you know, four or five people with me who I deeply trust. And at least one or two of them are going to be current members of the team. And a couple of people are going to be outside the team. And when I bring that group to the table, I give them each an area of focus. So, John, I like to take a strengths-based approach. We want to be a strengths and talent-driven organization. And so we believe people operate best from their strengths. So I'm looking at what are those four or five areas of strength that I want them to bring. One of the areas could be content creation. One of them could be instructional design. One of them could be editing, some of the things you touched on. But some of the other ones might be problem solving, creativity, being organized, communicating well, influencing up in the organization. And I set those parameters, and then each person on that interview panel is focused on only one of them. And I give them the autonomy to say, okay, this is all you're focused on. Ask questions in that vein. One of the things that does is it creates a good candidate experience from a recruiting perspective, because we all maybe have been to an interview at some point where every interview panelist asked us like the same question. I mean, how disengaging is that, right? They don't have their thing, their stuff together. They're not on the same page. And so that's one of the positive byproducts of this. But then when you give feedback on that candidate, everybody can speak to something different and you get this 360 view of the candidate. And then my role as the manager, every time I interview, is always team fit. I'm the gatekeeper of culture. I'm the gatekeeper of the team. I can't let someone in that's going to poison the water, so to speak. So I'm the team fit person. And if that person's not going to fit well with the good thing we got going, they're not coming in, and that's on me. And so that's the way I try to approach it. But it's a strengths-based approach rather than just competencies. It's great if you're a master of that, but if you don't relate well to other people, it's not going to work. So I'm looking for four or five things that I think are a potential strength or where that person can grow into those roles.
The gatekeeper, what is the gatekeeper of culture? Is that what you said?
Something like that. I think so. Yeah.
It's great. I mean, you know, I mean, yep. Thinking, taking a completely different view that you're the gatekeeper to ensure you keep the bad stuff out. I mean, it's really interesting, mental perspective. Let's end on some fun stuff. You wrote a book a couple years ago called Strive, and I know it's a kind of a daily or weekly devotional.
Yeah.
Why did you use that word strive?
Because I think striving is the daily struggle. It's a faith-based book, as you mentioned. The reality is, John, from that perspective of my life, faith is at the core. I fall short every day, but I'm striving, right? I'm working. I'll never quite get there, but I'm doing the best I can. And I think strive is a word that conveys trying, struggling, sometimes succeeding, sometimes I can do better tomorrow. It's that daily grind, right? Daily battle in our personal and professional lives that we're never quite there. We're never, attaining mastery, but we're just striving for it. We're working hard at it.
I'm going to ask you a question that it's been on my mind and heart. You work inside a large organization, but you're a deeply faith-based man. It's number one in your life, much like mine. How hard is it to table that when you come to work at a really large organization where there's tons of different faith perspectives?
Yeah. I'll be honest with you, John. I don't table it. I just don't use words. And so what I mean by that is, I hope that I am sharing my faith every day, whether I've said a word or not about it. I hope that it is, that here to serve email signature is sparking curiosity in someone else. I hope that being poised and having a positive outlook in the face of maybe some bad news is a witness to others, where at some point maybe I get the opportunity then to have a closed door discussion or have them say, hey, can I meet up with you before or after work? And, how can you be positive in the face of this? This is a terrible situation. And then you have the opportunity to share. And so I'm not going to be a Bible thumper. I'm not going to impose things on other people. Quite frankly, I think that turns people off. It's about living it first. Showing up every day, being faithful from the perspective of doing great work. There's a story about a man named Daniel, right, that we have probably all heard of Daniel in the lion's den. And why was he in a position of leadership and respect is because he was excellent at his job. He was excellent. He was given responsibility, and therefore he had opportunity to be an example. And so I try not to talk about it. I try to live it. And if it comes to then have an opportunity to share, that's an added bonus.
Oh, that was great. Model it, man. I tell this story all the time, and I even do it in workshops. There was an old, in World War II, there was an American soldier in Japan that was caught and went to a prisoner of war camp. And he was thrown in to a cell, but instead of being treated like a normal prisoner of war, he was treated really well. He was given three meals a day. Mm. He was given time to exercise. Just a week later, a Japanese soldier broke a rule and was thrown into the same cell, but he was not treated the same way. He was pulled out twice a day to be beaten. He was given very little food. But this American soldier and him got to be friends, and the American soldier would save food for him, and he would, you know, take care of his wounds when he was thrown back in after being beaten. And one night in particular, he was taken out. The Japanese soldier was taken out, and he was beaten, you know, really badly. And then he was thrown back in the cell. And the American soldier knew immediately that this guy was not going to make it through the night. And so as he was taking care of his wounds, he looked down at the Japanese soldier and he said, "It appears you're not going to make it. Would you like to know about Jesus?" Mm. And that soldier looked up at him and said, "I've heard about Jesus, but I think I already know him, because if he's anything like you've treated me, then I know who Jesus is." And yeah. I think there's some correlation to what you're saying there about your example, your modeling of it. You know, can people be interested in your faith walk because of the person that you are, because of how you treat them, because of how you serve them? I mean, it will be a different experience than someone that doesn't have that at their core. And I think it's a great way to position it in the workplace. Less verbal, more action. And so I appreciate you sharing that.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, the reality is the first way that I can earn credibility in the place that I am every day is by how good the work is that I do. I mean, if I don't do a good job for a team, or if somebody comes to us and says, "Hey, we need help working better together as a team," and we, from a training perspective, don't give them a good experience, I mean, what does that say about who we are as people, right? If this is a part of us. And so, yeah, I think the first opportunity I get oftentimes to have any kind of credibility is the quality of the work I do for someone else. And you just never know when you'll get that opportunity, as you said.
I love it. Let's start with performance.
Absolutely.
You're also a father. You're a husband. What's harder, leading at work or leading at home?
Oh, man. they're both hard. Each have their own challenges. I think, John, the journey I'm on at home is full presence, meaning when I get home, my mind is where my feet are, you know, and I'm fully there. And so it's been different things. You know, sometimes there's travel and sometimes there's different challenges. I think for me, it's starting with that personal leadership of, you know, like getting up early in the morning and guarding some time to start the day right and have that devotional and set my mind and set my heart for the day, which there are days when I fall short in that regard too. You know, kids wake up at odd times or different things happen, but it's fighting for that time, I think. And then it's trying to be intentional when I get home around, like, leaving on time as best I can and, you know, trying to be home at 5:30, and then leaving the phone on the counter, you know, just like separating from it physically. I've found I've had to do that. And if I can guard that time, you know, between like 5 and 8 or so and really be there. And then I can always work later, you know, when the kids are in bed and spend some time with my wife, Michelle, and, you know, get the laptop back out, but really guarding some of those key hours. It's one step on the journey. It's not perfect, but, leading at home, is ultimately the measure of, you know, who I am and how I am as a leader. I heard Andy Stanley say this once. I had the good honor of hearing him speak at a convention not that long ago. And he said something that really struck me that I would share with you, John, because I think it aligns with your heart is, you know, he said, "Hey, there's lots of other people that can do what you do, right? There's lots of other people in talent development. There's lots of other people in sales. There's lots of other people in whatever. But we all only get one unique job in our lives, and that's to parent our children, right? No one else can be a dad to, you know, Daniel James and Emma Grace, only me. And that's I'm the only person in the world that gets that job. A lot of other people can do what I do at Stryker. And so I have to take that very seriously. And that really struck a chord with me. And I hope that I can do that well.
I'm sure you are, man. I'm sure you are. You're doing your job at work well. You're doing your job at home well. And I think there's a great example. What's Michelle meant to you?
She's everything. She's my rock. I mean, if John, briefly, you know, she and I together have had a combined 16 surgeries. She was a basketball player in college. She's been through a lot physically. And the thing I think this says everything you need to know about her, through those, you know, 13 knee surgeries, and she actually has a partial knee replacement at a, you know, pretty young age here in our 30s. You'd never know it. I mean, she carries herself with a smile every day. She's one of the most empathetic people. And so having a teammate and a partner and a best friend that we can share the good and the struggle and communicate openly and be on this journey together, it's everything. It's, you know, marriage is the strength of your life. It's kind of that vortex. If your marriage is strong, you go to work strong. If it's not, you don't. And so I think it's investing there to be better in everything else you do.
Well, at least we know who wins the game of horse when you guys get out there shooting hoops.
There is no doubt about that.
She just steps out beyond the 3-point line and just wears you out, I'm sure.
Yes, that's true.
Well, Tim, we so appreciate you making the time to come on the show and share some of the wisdom that you've gained in your life. Where can people find out more about your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you want to connect with me on a personal level, I do have a website, timhiller.com, or I'm on Twitter a lot, timhiller3. TimHiller3. And I'm always happy to connect on LinkedIn as well. So those are three great ways if anybody wants to shoot me a note. I love talking talent development. I'm proud to work at Stryker. We're doing a lot of great things at a great organization, and it's been a fun journey.
Thanks for joining us in another week of the show. If you like this, do me a favor and share it with a colleague or a friend, or leave a comment, review, and recommendation wherever you listen to podcasts. Anything that would help us spread the message of leadership, it would mean a great deal to me in my heart.